Hi, this is Dave. Welcome. How's everybody doing?
Good. Hi, Dave. It's Kat.
Welcome, Kat. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Bring us up to date. What kind of wins, progress notes do you have?
I'm going to have to just sit here quietly for a minute and wake up.
Okay.
So I'm still having my coffee, so please forgive me.
Okay. That's great. Who else?
I just jumped on. This is Diane.
Welcome, Diane. How are you?
Good. How are you, Dave?
Great. What's going on with you?
I don't know. Just a little tired today. I heard someone else say they were tired. Interesting talking again on the same theme. A couple of women just totally, really paranoid about the profit sharing. Decision making last night. It sort of kept me out late. It was very interesting. That is the truth. Anyway, that was just of the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Great. How are you finding the each of you? How are you finding the material, and how does it fit with what you know and what you do already in coaching? Is it different in some ways? What's it like at this point? I know we're not even all the way through the roadmap yet, the fundamentals. But any impressions or thoughts about your experience?
I think it's actually really informative. I mean, I really enjoy understanding, in addition to listening to you, but the reinforcement is really, to me, terrific. The different parts of the brain, as I was reading today, and how emotions kick in. It all makes a lot of sense, yet finding an inroad with somebody that is very closed, I still think, is a very big challenge.
Yeah, and this is simply a way to really understand, not a methodology necessarily at this point, but just a way to have an informed way of listening, to understand, to be able to deconstruct a story, to look at then how you can collaborate to look at creating a new one or a revised one with someone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any other thoughts from anyone else? Anyone else want to check in? Lynn, Chris? I think Chris is still away.
Dave, hi. It's Chris Teasdale. I just joined in, and I'm
great.
In my car, so I'm a mute while I'm racing to the house to get onto the landline.
Okay. Any updates or progress notes for you?
For me?
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, I thought that this fourth module was read to that. Since I think I'm the only one in the group that has zero, coaching experience. I mean, I read through this, and I thought this made a lot of sense. There's a lot of depth to it, and I felt like it was a really good module as far as if you're coaching with someone and you can kind of pick up some of the items that they're talking about as far as getting locked in, where there's sort of a, how do I describe it, where you're sort of locked into a pattern that you don't want to be in, and kind of gives you a good roadmap on how to break that.
Okay, all right.
I'm really looking forward to learning more about that process.
Yeah, okay, great. And be thinking, each of you, about the write-up, just the brief write-up, a couple of pages of a case. It can be any case that you work with, any story aspect of that, or any aspect of your own work with yourself, and we'll schedule those for the latter part of the seminar series and dedicate 15 minutes to those for just a 2 or 3 minute presentation, and then the remainder of a discussion. I think doing those and us discussing them will really create more of a sense of understanding and mastery of listening as well. Yeah, so thanks. Anything that has come up in your work with clients or in the reading that you'd like to talk about? Everybody's clear as a bell? Well, what I'll do then is move into the material, and then we'll have a bit more time at the end to discuss. And again, don't hesitate to interrupt me so that we can amplify or expand on something that might be helpful to look at. So far, we've discussed the first five steps of the roadmap: to recognize authorship, own a present story, assess a story plot and storylines, decide what to change, and map changes. We're going to talk about writing new software today, and step six is about writing new software, specifically authoring new experiences. Now, we trust our stories. They're our reality. And for any of us, we are not in an old story. We're not even in a story. And you think about your clients. They're not thinking about things in terms of old story, new story. Not even that they're writing a story. It's just, this is the way things are. This is reality. So when our stories and our behaviors don't fit, we experience disharmony. Then we'll have to change one or the other to restore harmony. Sometimes we revise our stories. Sometimes we change how we see reality. Now, we've considered if your story doesn't allow you to do certain things. If your story, for example, is that you're a procrastinator, it will disallow you from finishing early. If your story says you don't do technology well, then you will never, or that you'll never acquire significant wealth, then you'll probably live out this assumption. And some beliefs are like a bad map. They won't get you where you want to go. So let's look at an application first of step five, map change, and step six, author new experience, applied to a debt story. And I'd recommend doing the three exercises under debt story in step five if you haven't already. Now, if money were about math, we wouldn't need to be talking. If money were about math, no one would have personal debt, at least. But more than math, money is about emotions and psychology. It's about each individual's money story. To encumber debt, the fact that you may not be able to afford something becomes concealed or cordoned off or just denied. We partition what we want from the reasons we shouldn't have it, or the fact that we can't afford it. So what do you really want when you want money? Is it what you buy when you don't have money and pay with debt? We need money to know what we can't buy. So here are some of the self-talk narratives that you're probably familiar with hearing various people say to justify spending in debt. It's just money. You can't take it with you. You only live once, just this one time. Now, the debt cycle that we can establish by a scenario of compulsive spending can result in a self-reinforcing cycle where there's a compulsion to spend and then a shame and then kind of a disavowal, a denial of it, resulting in further compulsion because spending makes you feel better, but then you have to deal with the expense of spending money you didn't have. You can fulfill a desire you didn't know you had by spending money you don't have. You can define yourself by acquisitions not paid for. You can even borrow based on how much money you'll be lended rather than how much money you can pay back. So spending money generates the perception, both by the spender and the observer, of having money. And marketers know this. Fulfilling a wish creates the desire. And when the desires define identity, the quest can become unrelenting. So many people who fall heavily into debt don't necessarily have psychological problems, but because spending takes on a life of its own. You know, I mentioned to you that my first client as a professional coach was a woman, a professional colleague of mine, who had been waiting for me to open my practice to work with me, but it took several months before she finally admitted to me that she had $500,000 worth of debt, and her husband didn't know it. She could barely service the debt, and she was increasingly stressed and succumbing to the demands of this. With spending, the chase is on. Someone tries to afford what they buy, and money can never buy what it represents emotionally. So this is how spending money is addictive. It changes the state of mind. And remember, just the anticipation of spending changes a state of mind. In fact, there was a fairly recent study that showed that credit card holders are consciously aware of only $4 out of every $10 they owe. Not just, you know, have a reasonable guess, but they're not aware of $6 of every $10 that they owe. The underestimation is a form of denial. And debt has been called a secret sin because of the shame attached. So the way our minds and brains are wired, it's hard to save money because there's the immediate pleasure of buying. It activates the same pleasure center in the brain that dopamine does. It in fact, generates dopamine. It's difficult to substitute a theory like a future need or long-term saving or retirement for the immediate. And the most common way we're short-sighted in our decision-making is that we choose a small amount of something right now rather than a larger amount in the future. In fact, here's what an expert had to say. This is Uncle Junior to his nephew, Tony Soprano. You know, your father and me started that poker game over 30 years ago. We were talking one day about how the credit card companies, you know, they work their angle. How they don't care what you bought as long as you don't pay all at once. They juice you to death and you thank them for letting you have a card. You'd rather be juiced than pay all at once. It's a certain kind of player. That's why they call it the executive game. So we render money an abstraction and deceive ourselves. I can do it on my credit card so it won't be an immediate expense. As Richard Medley said, free money makes you stupid. And a very simple statement was from a Frontline documentary called The Secret History of the Credit Card. And the quote was, it's nice to be able to spend what you don't have. One book I would recommend, if any of you might be interested in this, is Jeanine Roth's book, Lost and Found. It's her account of being a Madoff victim. And she's an incredible writer. She's had a number of New York Times bestseller books, mostly for women in food and other related areas. But this is her own story about her journey with being a Madoff victim. It's incredibly well written. I think you'd enjoy it, really get some insight about it. Here are some possibilities to counter each of these tendencies. Neuroeconomist Ben Seymour at University College in London has shown that imagining a future purchase can have the same effect in the brain as getting it. Saving is easier when it's for something specific that we can envision. For example, it's easier and more specific and effective to create a distinct vision for each goal, such as a vacation, a college tuition, a new house. Also, some other things that might be strategies. Tangibly calculate the cost of debt so that it becomes real figures. And concretely represent the magic of compound interest. In other words, if you're about to spend $100, figure out what the money you spend at compound interest. In other words, if it were in a retirement account and had compound interest, what it would be worth in 10 years. At retirement. Remember that idea from when you were a kid, just pay me a penny a day and double it for a month? The eighth wonder of the world is not that new mall in Dubai that's twice as big as one in Minnesota. It's compound interest. And one more. Automatically, and we talked about this before, automatically deduct retirement savings each month. This is a commitment device, a decision that you only have to make once. Now, as we talk about creating a new money story in this step, basically, of authoring new experiences, let's look a little bit at the dynamics of change. This is something that you'll see, and you won't see these in a stepwise or a headline way, but first, the idea of change in every client, it will create some kind of excitement. then as it's on the cusp of action, a trepidation, maybe even an anxiety. And if they continue, rather than return to a comfort zone, expansion into a new experience and the feeling, the experience of effectiveness. And then finally, mastery. Now, there are a couple of additional aspects of experiencing change that may seem paradoxical. We're going to talk about transition at a later point, but this is just the first step here about change. Every step forward means relinquishing a past position. In other words, someone must mourn. They must say goodbye emotionally as well as practically to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story, even one that doesn't work that well. This is a process, a developmental step. It's not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it and change it. It's really like saying goodbye to an old friend to give up a habit, a pattern of behavior, or a hope that by getting the old story just right or doing it better will make it work. And the second is the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. In other words, changing is a narcissistic injury. To think about the very best way that you fashioned to do something, and now you find there's something better. This carefully crafted old story, even with some aspects of identity attached, is replaced by something better. So I think there are some components in this dynamic of change. And again, these are not headlines. You won't see signs that you can label. These are just for your reflection, maybe to think of like internal conceptual markers. The myth that there's a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice will solve all problems. The disappointment that nothing is really perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. The development, the recognition that no one's going to take it care of, that no one's going to take care of it for you. Kind of the final step into adulthood to realize that nobody's going to take care of it for you. The growth to take the next best action. And the consolidation, the happy-sad experience that results. Happy about the effectiveness of not constructing an obstacle and about moving ahead. And sad about giving up and mourning the old story. So an aspect of this is to recognize and understand emotional comfort. Oh, I wanted to add, by the way, to be sure and do at some point the money mission statement exercise beginning page 6.2 in the workbook. It can orient and guide in the same way that a mission statement does for an organization. So let's talk a little bit about recognizing and understanding emotional couplings. Regardless of how logical we think we are, our first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Any input goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain and then to the hippocampus, still in the midbrain, to attach meaning. And again, this is where our unconscious resides, is in the hippocampus, where meaning is attached. Then it's kicked up to the forebrain to be processed consciously and logically and intellectually. In other words, to have it light on something that makes conscious and logical sense. So what this means is the emotional activation registered before cognitive areas of the brain come into play. Neuroscientists have demonstrated that we make decisions, especially buy decisions to purchase, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware of them. When we make a choice, we usually couple memory and wisdom from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. Now, here's a paradox in brain functioning. The part of the brain that anticipates pleasant outcomes, the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center, gets activated when we decide to buy something and anticipate purchasing or spending. A don't buy decision originates in the insula. It's an area that's involved in anticipating pain. The anticipatory emotions can bias as well as drive decision-making. Decision-making process in the brain shortcuts of analysis include things like brands or familiarity or trust. So basically what this means is that we can separate the pleasure of purchase and the chemical stimulation of pleasure from the pleasure center by a purchase that is then segmented from the payment like a credit card. And we touched on this before, but think about how this segments the pleasure from the pain and fosters the use of a credit card. In fact, as we've discussed before, about 23% more purchase with a credit card occurs than when you pay with a check or with cash. So what that means is the associations that we have to money and the pleasure of spending money needs to be balanced also with the big picture so that decisions don't get skewed in some way. So we have a challenge. These are some questions to accompany, to accompany important choices. We have a challenge. We have to do two things. To recognize this process, that different parts of our brain works in different ways, and to understand and objectify the emotional couplings that can derail logic. So there are a couple of simple questions we have to ask with each important choice that we make. What choices are worth making? How much does each choice cost? And the meanings that we attach determine the emotional impact. So by changing a meaning, we can change the emotional impact. The simple act of reappraisal can begin a new story with a different emotional impact. So with awareness, we can alter our responses and actually choose our responses. We can write a different money story. Now, I want to talk a little bit about thinking outside the box, but I want to pause to see, is this making sense to you? Does it seem to fit with what you know? This is really just a kind of a preamble to authoring new experiences. We're going to talk about some specifics of this, but I thought it might be helpful to look at some considerations of how the mind and brain work so that there's a context for this so that we understand it. So any thoughts or questions or experiences in this regard?
Dave, this is Kat.
Yeah, please.
I found something yesterday in doing the work in the workbook that actually replaces, for me personally, the high of shopping. And
wow.
I can see how...
Follow that sucker and sell it. What do you got?
For me personally, it was just sitting down and learning. It was that made me happier than just the shopping itself. And I do an awful lot of shopping. I mean, you know, that's probably a different story, but that's what I do with my free time. Let's put it that way. Shop a lot. I don't create debt, but I shop an awful lot. And I found that just by sitting down and doing the book and any type of learning that I do, it's actually, the high from that is higher than sitting, or it's greater than just sitting down and pointing and clicking for me personally. So I can see where that replaces for me the high from shopping, and you were just talking about. That's my new money story. I'm loving it.
You know, that's really interesting because you've substituted a different kind of reward system. You've substituted, instead of the sprint system of dopamine, that there's a quick rush and a high and then it tails off and you have to do it all over again, you substituted the marathon system that has to do with ideals and values and substituting a greater pleasure, though maybe not as immediately high as the high of shopping, but still, overall, cumulatively, a very different kind of pleasure. That's very interesting.
Dave, is that a bad thing? Now that you mention it, it's replacing one with another.
I don't think it's a bad thing at all. And if it works, it's great, and it's enhancing, and it fits with your needs and ideals, where I'm not sure if the shopping did or not.
It didn't.
The shopping was temporary. So whatever you do, whenever you're goals and strategies fit with needs and ideals, and you find a greater pleasure. You know, we've talked before, the two basic motivations that we have is to avoid pain and to seek pleasure. And whenever we do anything that, let me say that a different way. If we're not doing something that we, for all logical and conscious reasons, want to do, need to do, have committed to do, but find ourselves not doing it, there's something going on that we're avoiding pain. So it might be helpful to look at behavior in terms of avoiding pain and seeking pleasure. And there's a greater charge to avoiding pain. In fact, it's twice as painful to lose $100 as it is to gain $100. And that's something that neuroscientists have shown again and again. So what you're doing then is substituting a longer-term gain, a greater pleasure, for an immediate pleasure, and avoiding the pain of the payback. So, you know, whenever you shop, or whenever you create debt, it does a number of things. First of all, in a very simple way, you just simply have to pay more for it, because you have to pay for the debt, you have to service the debt. But also you have to deal with your error detection mechanism, because part of your brain, you can't fool, your brain is saying, wait a minute, you're spending money we don't have. So, and then you have to work at paying the interest. So it's a lot of work. It sounds like a very effective method that you've developed. Very effective.
For me, this is going to work well. Like I said, I don't create debt when I'm shopping. I pay everything off at the end of the month. But I do spend a tremendous amount of money. And for me, personally, that money could go into the savings account instead of being spent. And that's what I'm working toward, is to stop the spending on frivolous items, put it into savings, and I found out last night I can replace it with something that's even more pleasurable. This was a huge aha moment for me. I'm so pleased.
Yeah.
So pleased. My nose is definitely going to be stuck in your book, in the workbook.
You know, if you have a table that you can easily do this, it might be interesting to look at what you might have spent during the month, and if you put that into a retirement account, what that would be worth at the time of your retirement. I think you'd be amazed with compound interest.
I think you'd be amazed if you heard how much I spent. I do know to the penny how much I spent last year, and I'm on track for that again this year, and it's time to stop.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm just going to add to that. Sorry. I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
Okay. Should I go or should I wait?
No, please go.
Diane, I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Oh, I was going to add to that one simple thing that I began doing a few years ago, which is really effective, is to just, when you see something that you like, just take a picture of it on your iPhone, and that way you can, A, have it forever, and when you get home and you look at whatever it is, and does it really fit into your budget, and does it really fit into your closet or your home or whatever, you always have that chance to go back and to get it. But number one, you already have it, so you can really look at it whenever you want, okay? And if it really does make sense, you haven't wasted your time. So I've found it to be a great tool for a variety of different reasons. And, you know, it also, the pleasure of looking at things visually and shopping, there's, you know, for some of us, it really gives you a lot of different ideas, and there's some satisfaction to it in small doses. But, you know, seeing your choices and then feeling good about the choices that you actually do make, because there are things that we do need to shop for, I just found it to be a really effective tool. And sometimes, you know, you go back and you look at what you took pictures of, and you're like, oh, so glad I didn't get that. So you can just delete it from your phone. But it's just another tool, I think, that may be effective because there are times where you just need to, you know, just sort of go and look and see what's out there, you know, and how to assimilate that into your life also.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's a very effective strategy. And let me expand a little bit on why I think that works. Because whenever we get into a position of you know, we have a stimulation of about to purchase something, and the stimulation comes not from the purchase, but from actually the anticipation of purchase. Because once we purchase, that's when there's a shift to a different system, and that's why there's buyer's remorse often or less excitement than we think about. But what you're describing doing is changing the state of mind to move from that state of the anticipatory excitement to kind of sleep on it, to go through different states and then revisit it, to come back to it and assess it in a different way when there's more balance, when there's not the anticipatory excitement there. And that's one, one of my blogs is about how the shopping experience can be contagious, because once you buy something, you're much more likely to buy something else because you've induced or created a state that you're going to perpetuate, and you're much more likely, and there's some studies that have shown how much more likely you are to buy additional things when you make that first purchase. There's also a blog that I have that some of you may be interested in. It's called 14 Ways to Outsmart Your Brain to Spend Less. And it speaks to, you know, one of those speaks to some of the strategy that you mentioned. I think you put very, very well. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. Those are interesting strategies that you created.
Yeah. And, Dave, the other aspect, I sort of label it as, you know, with a couple of other things that, you know, mm-hmm. I do, even raising children, you know, the 24-hour rule, which is after 24 hours, you know, if you take a look at it again and it's absolutely necessary and, you know, at that point you've decided it's something that's worthwhile to purchase, you know, that's terrific. But if you don't think ahead about what's going on Friday night or Saturday night or whatever, it's the same planning piece. And it, you know, I've just been using it for a while, and I just tell people up front, if I'm at a car dealership or whatever, you know, I'm really here to shop, not to buy. You know, I have a personal, you know, personal rule, et cetera. And therefore, it really saves everybody, because they can give you information, but they already know that you're not going to decide right then and there, and you have already spoken it. So therefore, you're more likely to follow through on it. So it's effective.
That's really a good way to state your intention, because, you know, once we state an intention, we're much more likely to follow through on it. So you're making your intention very clear for you and for us. So that's a favor. That's interesting.
Yes.
Dave, I was going to tell you that last weekend we had an estate sale, and one of the things we did was we got what they call a square that you can hook into your iPhone or your iPad.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And charge with credit card. And I got to say, I mean, this was a target-rich environment for COVID because, I mean, there was more people making ridiculous decisions. And when we told them that they had the opportunity to pay by credit card, they even bought more.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just, I mean, so what a lot of we're talking about, we had firsthand knowledge. If you ever want to pick up customers or clients, have an estate sale. I mean, you'll just see people making mm-hmm. crazy decisions, and then, you know, of course, you don't advertise it until after the estate sale that you're a coach.
That's great. And that's even better than having the machine where you have to swipe the credit card. You just, you know, put it and read it. That's even better. That's more effective. That's great. That's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I was at a meeting. I had to miss this group for in one of our panels we were talking about. I heard a definition of addiction that sounded even simpler and more succinct than I'd heard before, and it really kind of resonated. An addiction can be defined as when a behavior becomes the central organizing factor of your life. So that means, obviously, anything, any behavior, process, person, thing can become addictive, because if it's a central organizing factor of your life, it can be pretty powerful. This was a money conference. Yeah, so thanks for those examples. Those really bring it to life. So as we're thinking about our story, we're often encouraged to think outside the box. But have you ever thought about what that really means? How do you do that? What is the box, and how do you think outside it? Randall Kennedy put it really succinctly: thinking that frees itself of reflexive obedience from familiar signals. This is one of the quotes I saw not too long ago, written on the student union wall at Princeton. How do you know when you're in the box to get out of it, to revise your story or write another one? Now, these questions assume the story is there, that they're just a given in the universe, as if the story, this proverbial box of the familiar and accepted, is the obstacle. But it's not there until we create it or accept it. And people are always free to change their minds, their beliefs, their core assumptions. The box is the result of programming and conditioning. It's self-created in adulthood. And they're not a bad thing. They're simply ways we've come and our brains have come to move to the default mode. So they don't have to be limiting. They can be defining, guiding, validating, expandable, make a lot of decisions really easy. It can be as simple as a point of view. People looked at Goliath and thought he was too big to hit. David looked at him and thought he was too big to miss. So listen, for example, to these different boxes to hear how very arbitrary and situational each one is, each with its own intrinsic set of beliefs, behaviors, and rules. People treat a piece of processed leather as if it were sacred. They protect it, hide it, try to steal it. There are all kinds of rules about what you can and can't do with it, even who can touch it or hold it. If it crosses an arbitrary line somebody draws, it can count for different points. +2, -2, 3, sometimes 6. Football. Another, it moves in and out of your life, varies daily. You want more, but may keep doing the same thing not to get it. Two people can do the very same thing and obtain really different quantities. You can buy it or sell it, but the price changes daily, even moment by moment. It's a stand-in for what you want, even for what you despise. It's the most desired legal substance to all people of the world. Money. And a final one. There's no clear definition of winning. It's always at risk. There's always a price to pay. There's always another level of success. Your money story, your life story. So let's apply this notion to writing the next chapter of a money story. The box can be limiting or inflexible. The canal boat companies of the 1700s didn't become the railroad companies of the 1800s. They stuck to their box. And in the 1900s, there were no Union Pacific Airlines. They stuck to their box. Good to gone. Motorola stuck to their story and slid from a premier electronics firm to a troubled industry. Meanwhile, Nokia asked and listened to children and young people just developing their stories and used their feedback to become world class. Good to great. So open yourself to possibilities you haven't quite imagined yet. Scarcity is a rigid box. Abundance is expandable. No one can grant you freedom. You have to declare it. No one gives you power. You have to generate it, claim it, and not give it away. To simply stop doing something is not complete change. A new story means incorporating new behaviors and beliefs. You have to embody, actually live your new story. To abstain from an old story, like stuckness or repetition, is a beginning, but you have to engage a new story before you can totally give up an old story. So let's look at some AAA principles of change. This is in your outline, to author a new money story. And the three A's are awareness, acceptance, and action. One, you're writing your own story. Is it working? For each component, what are the results? Honestly assess each of these storylines with a question, is it working? And make that a yes or no. Your personal wellness story, mind, body, and spirit. Your business career story. Your relationship story. Your money story. When I ask people what they most look forward to and what they are most afraid of for the next chapters of their lives, they often respond with vague dreams, yet specific fears. The top of the list of long-term concerns, usually health and money. A not-so-secret to success is that you have to pay in full for that success. So you might as well find out what the price is, pay it in full, pay it as soon as possible, and then enjoy the benefits of the success. The price is always some form of energy, whether that energy is money, time, work, or experience. If you get something for which you haven't provided value or benefit, you'll still have to pay in some way. We've discussed how if you purchase something before you've earned the money, you simply end up paying more for it. Now, here's another non-secret. People who truly enjoy getting what they want are those who enjoy paying the price. I'm doing it right now. I love this, and I believe it will really make a difference in your lives and for your clients. So it's not even paying a price. It's following a passion. The price is whatever you need to give in order to generate exactly what you want. Your why. Two, you're writing your own story. It takes just as much energy to create any belief in that story. Positive or negative, present, past, future, adaptive or maladaptive, the same energy. The energy of scarcity, or the belief of scarcity really, takes just as much energy as the belief of abundance. You generate the energy and give power to your story. Simple math says that when you use your attention to focus on what you don't have, you deplete your energy to engage what you do have. Here's the subtle but crucial distinction. You give specific power to your story, and then it assumes a momentum and power of its own. Remember, you're not the subject of that process, you're the creator of it. And here's a short list of some results when you focus on what you don't want. Fear, anxiety, anger, confusion, annoyance, helplessness, guilt. Three, you're writing your own story. Decide what you want. The primary reason people don't get what they want is they're not quite sure what they want. Here's a neuroscience law of attraction question. How does the brain work like a travel agent? First two questions travel agent asks, where do you want to go? When do you want to get there? And a goal then is like MapQuest. You program in where you want to go, make a map, and determine the time. Now, a caveat here is to know what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. And consider this. What you resist, you draw toward you. Remember, we get what we focus on. Resistance is an engagement. It's kind of like saying anger is as passionate an attachment as love. They're both powerful attachments. An example of this principle is Paul Conrad, political cartoonist, who said of Charles Coughlin, a 1940s radio preacher, I knew that anybody who had to holler that loud couldn't be right. So, if you find yourself resisting change, it's already occurred. And most suffering is the result of resisting what already is. People resist going to the doctor, but they aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial is going to be confronted. Four, you're writing your own story. Do you have specific, measurable goals? In a Harvard study begun in the mid-1950s, 10 to 15% of the Harvard Business School graduates had fashioned a vision and specific goals for their life in business. 5 decades later, those 10 to 15% had 90% of the assets of the entire group. Another more recent study was done of Dartmouth graduates, and as striking the figures, actually slightly more than this group. Motivation increases as soon as you're clear about the goal and the payoff. Focus enhances when you have a specific plan and strategy. So look at these three components. Look at the exercise in the workbook. 10 steps to advance the plot of your new money story. I want to highlight three components in particular. Establish SMART goals. As you know, specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, time bound. And a timetable here is 30 to 90 days. And then for each SMART goal, determine three key initiatives. And the timetable here is about 7 to 10 days. And then for each initiative, decide on the next best action. And the timetable here is about 24 hours. So you're laddering the movement forward. As soon as you achieve the next best action, you look at the next best action to get to that first initiative. When you complete an initiative, you look at the next initiative to get to the goal. It's estimated that less than 10% of people have measurable goals. 100% of people have good ideas, at least some. The difference between a good idea and a goal, measurement and time, where and when, the travel agent questions. Here's a good idea. I'd like to lose weight. Here's a goal. I will reach 185 pounds by March 31st, 2014. Here's a good idea. I want to save more money for retirement. Here's a goal. I will pay myself first by setting up an automatic transfer of $400 to my retirement fund the first of every month from my checking account. Then write a breakthrough goal, something that would stretch you, bring incredible opportunities, move you to a higher level, a quantum leap, getting a book on the New York Times bestseller list, spending every March skiing in Steamboat Springs, and every August riding on the coast of Maine. Now, each of you will have to substitute your own goals there. Then reread your goals, regular and breakthrough, twice a day, when you wake up and when you go to bed. 5. You're writing your own story. Small changes lead to big changes. Issues that seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify a step to take for progress. For example, if you feel overwhelmed at work with the amount of tasks, identify one specific thing that you can do in the next 24 hours that will give you some traction. This focus on a simple, specific action creates a sense of effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Since he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed to average 24 miles a day and completed the run in 143 days. As soon as he completed the race, he was interviewed immediately and asked, how did he keep himself going when he was exhausted and he still had thousands of miles left? His response, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. So divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. During my specialty training in psychiatry, one of my first-year supervisors had a really puzzling picture on the wall. It was a photograph in which everything just seemed curiously out of focus. As I met with him every week, I'd glance at the photograph until finally toward the end of the year, I asked him about it. He said, look carefully, Dave, what do you see? I walked over to the photograph to get a closer look. Closer didn't help. It still seemed out of focus. I saw no particular aesthetic value. My experience and considerable interest in photography didn't help a bit. I said, Steve, the only thing I noticed is that there's one branch of one tree in focus in the entire picture. He nodded. He said, exactly. That's why I have it hanging there. It's my reminder that while things may seem confusing and blurry, there's always at least one thing that you can have in focus and see clearly, which is why he was a great supervisor for first-year residents. 6, you're writing your own story. Be consistent in the pursuit of your goals. It takes a minimum of 25 to 30 days to etch a new pathway in your brain to make it permanent. Remember the NASA astronauts. So write your story consistently for it to become the default mode. The difference between a genius idea and a true story of success, Malcolm Gladwell tells us in Outliers, is about 10,000 hours of dedicated work to develop mastery. 7, you're writing your own story. The benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what isn't working will become evident and self-perpetuating. Now, this is all really simple. Good parents have known this for centuries, but sometimes It takes human science and cognitive research to remind us of the obvious. We can foster change by conscious practices and effective tools. An infinite sea of new patterns and possibilities can be created to further new goals. The caveat? You have to take action to diminish pre-programmed responses and to write new script for new experiences. In other words, once again, the new story has to replace the old one. And there are no shortcuts, really, since long-term change requires consistent practice, repetition, to groove new neuronal pathways and establish new neural networks. But there are effective and efficient methods to accelerate more optimum change and to ensure transformation. 8. You're writing your own story. Ask for feedback. To your spouse or partner, ask, on a scale of 1 to 10, rate the quality of our relationship. If you do this, you can get direct feedback and learn what you can address. Everybody else is probably on it anyhow, so you might as well be too. Maybe you just need to ask. To your employees and colleagues, on a scale of 1 to 10, how am I doing? And then, how can I get to 10? A tribe in southern Africa called the Bedimba has an interesting practice. When they hear a story of a person doing something wrong, something that destroys the social net of their tight community, all work in the village halts. The people gather around the offender and one by one recite all that that person has done right in his life. Good deeds, responsible behavior, thoughtful acts. This honest feedback on misbehavior has a time-honored consequence to allow the person to reclaim the better part of himself. He remembers who he is and why he is important to the life of the village. This may have been an original 360-degree feedback. But now, even without this kind of social network and feedback, we can relax and remember our way back into alignment with our true selves. We can get centered and reconnect with our true essence. So, in one way of thinking about it, find people who already are successfully doing what you want and get what you want. Research what they do in order to do your own version of it. Ask, learn, question, do your homework, build connectedness, make reasonable requests, something easy and mutually beneficial, but make it your story. Guess who said this? It's not that I'm so smart, it's that I stay with problems longer. It was Albert Einstein. And here's what to me is an interesting statistic. After giving a complete presentation about the benefits of their service or product, more than 60% of the time, seasoned salespeople don't ask for the order. How to ask is crucial. Ask clearly, confidently, sincerely. Virginia Satir, the well-known family therapist, was hired by the Michigan State Department of Social Services to submit a proposal on how to restructure the Department of Social Services to better serve the client population. 60 days later, she provided the department with a 150-page report. They said two things. This is the most amazing report, and how did you come up with all these brilliant ideas? She said, well, I asked all the social workers in your department what it would take for the system to work better. Now, a sidebar here. You've noticed, probably, that each of these AAA principles of change to author a new story begins the same way. You're writing your own story. That's the first four steps of the roadmap. Recognize, observe, assess, and decide, compressed into the shorthand of awareness and acceptance. The third A, the remaining steps, mapping change and authoring new experiences in 12 action steps. 9. You're writing your own story. Get success insurance. Instead of waiting for good luck. Luck is defined as probability taken personally, or my favorite, narcissism meets chance. Now, there's a review of research on goal setting. It's in the workbook section. And it was conducted by the leading person, one of the initial practitioners and researchers in executive coaching, Marshall Goldsmith, that helps us understand two essential components. Why people give up on goals, and there's a list there of the six most common reasons people give up on goals. And what that tells us is that by being aware of that and addressing those can create long-term achievement, success insurance, in other words. So reviews those six most important reasons people give up on goals because the inverse is success insurance. 10, you're writing your own story. Take a chance. You didn't have a New York Times bestseller before you sent your manuscript to an agent. If you get it rejected, you still don't. So what do you got to lose? What's the problem? You spent your whole life not having a New York Times bestseller. A young chiropractor just out of professional school wanted to open a practice in Carmel, California. He was told he'd never make it. There's already one chiropractor for every 8 people in Carmel. He went to 12,500 homes and talked to 6,500 people. He asked basically 3 questions. Which location should I open my office, the north or west side of town? Should I have extra office hours from 7 to 9 in the morning or 5 to 7 in the afternoon? And which newspaper should I advertise in? And then he added as he was leaving, when I have an open house party, would you like an invitation? In the first month, he took in $72,500, and in his first year, he netted over $1 million. 11, you're writing your own story. It's never too late to start. Don't let conventional wisdom or limiting assumptions ghostwrite your story. Cliff Beon was a 61-year-old Australian sheep herder. He heard about a cross-country race from Sydney to Melbourne and decided to enter. He showed up in Oshkosh overalls and work boots. The officials looked at him like he was crazy. They said, this is a race of over 800 kilos. The most seasoned runners in the world compete. Do you have any running experience and equipment? He said, yeah. I run after my sheep every day and got these boots and this baseball cap. When the race began, the world-class runners took off as they were trained to begin. Cliff started shuffling along in his boots. You're supposed to run 18 hours and sleep 6, but nobody told Cliff this, because initially, at least when the other runners were sleeping, he just kept shuffling along. They were all asleep and couldn't tell him he was supposed to keep running. He shuffled along for days. He cut 5.5 hours off the world record. We each have beliefs that limit us. Find the story that will improve you and start believing that. If there were no barriers, what would your ideal life be? And 12, you're writing your own story. Everything is okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. Ed Lorenz conceptualized chaos theory in the 1960s in this way. The initial state of events may seem unrelated and random, but eventually a pattern emerges, and in the end, all the pieces fit together. It's really the study of phenomena that appear random, but in fact have an element of regularity, which can be described eventually using a different organizing perspective, but one that's not evident or visible in the beginning. In the end, all the pieces fit together. Virginia Woolf, from a very different perspective, put it very simply, arrange whatever pieces come your way. So what are your thoughts about this material, and what kind of questions do you have? What is it saying to you? First, any questions or clarification about it?
Hi, David. It's Lynn.
Yeah, please. Hey.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
Yeah, you sound a little bit under the weather.
it's a long story that I'll tell you very briefly. I have a step cat, my stepdaughter's cat. And she comes and, you know, lays and takes a nap on my lap desk sometimes when I do classes. But she gets in fights. She's an indoor-outdoor cat. Gets in fights with neighborhood cats. And she has a terrible record. I mean, I keep wanting to give her, you know, karate lessons, but she gets beaten often. And she's the sweetest cat, but she's a calico. She can't pass up a fight. So she came back all wounded. So Saturday, when I got back from the ranch, I had to had to take her up to the cat ER, the pet ER. And immediately when I sat down, I felt something at the back of my throat. I knew I got something as soon as I walked in that place. So I've got kind of some kind of allergic reaction. I sound, you know, I have my total energy and alertness, but I sound terrible. So thank you. So dare you ask again because of another story. Yeah, go ahead, please.
I signed on, but I didn't say hello at the beginning because it was so noisy on the train. It always is.
Ah.
But it's really great. It's what was your question now? What did I make of it, or what did I get from it, or the from the call today?
Or anything you'd like to talk about, or any cases that you'd like to talk about? We'd ask about that at the beginning too.
No, the thing that I'm getting really, something that I've always, and I'm still to this day with all the coaching that I've gotten, is to keep the balance when your emotions start hijacking your intelligence, you know?
Yes.
So it's I find I've gotten coached on it with a couple of things to consider, like to move to kind of soften or to kind of put a damper on the emotions to keep my straight thinking there. And but it's still something that I deal with, you know, because I have a short fuse. Like, you know, I get it from either my mom, I think, but I need to give up that story because my mom, bless her soul, she's passed away now and she's gone. So, but it's still, like, you know, it's still innate in my head where I get triggered, you know, emotionally. So, and that's just my Siamese cat there meowing in the background. But anyways, so in reading the material in that, and I know we're going to cover more of that as part of the states of mind.
Exactly.
In that chapter, but that's what I got present to again. You know, just having it and just reinforcing it and keeping it where I have to practice it in order to get it to a science. So I'm not, you know.
It's great to have that in awareness and to know to work on it. And we are going to spend some specific time looking at master states of mind, because I think from exactly what you just said, I think that mastering states of mind is the most crucial success strategy that we can have in life, in business, in anything that we do. And I think it really can define success. And there are specific ways that we have. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and send the neuroconditioning work chart as a preparation for that module, and it may be something you want to look at beforehand, because I think what you just said is absolutely intuitively correct to identify the cues or the triggers. Let's just do a brief foreshadowing of that. Take a single sheet of paper, and I'm going to send you something that you can really use, and will be a refined version of this, but take a single sheet of paper and draw three vertical lines so that you have four columns. In the first column, put emotional cues or triggers. In the second column, put usual behavioral response. In the third column, put mantra, M-A-N-T-R-A. It's a combination of three things, a cue that you'll use to get centered and grounded, and a couple of ways, the most powerful ways to regulate a state of mind to get centered and grounded, focus and physiology. And we'll talk more about that specifically when we get there. And the fourth column is ideal behavior or ideal response. Let me just tell you an application of this. When I first developed this, I was working with an executive woman, really, really brilliant, accomplished woman in a national position, and she had one thing that she was having such trouble. We mostly worked on executive coaching, but major holiday, I can last maybe about a day because I have some techniques to do that. But then my resilience wanes, my threshold lowers, and then I just absolutely lose it because of the triggers and the ways that I get into it with my parents. So what we did was develop this chart. I've refined it since, but basically it was this chart. And I recommended to her to schedule a brainstorming session with herself, like a 30-minute session, uninterrupted, to get in a state of mind to really think about the cues or the triggers and what happens with those, not to recreate them, because you can't, you know, once you're in a state of mind, you can't manage that to, you know, by moving to another state of mind. You can't think or logic your way out of it. You have to get centered again. So to look at the usual cues or triggers, every one of them, like a particular way that her mom would look at her, a particular phrase that her dad would say, or, you know, every one of the cues and triggers, and what her immediate response, her reactive mode was to that cue or that trigger. And then I had her at a different time to look at what she wanted to do, how she would strategize to get grounded and centered. And I'll share as we get to that. You know, I don't think we have time for it right now, but a way to get grounded and centered, and what her ideal behavior would be, what her ideal response would be, so that for every cue or trigger that would set her off, that she would have an early recognition. And those first two columns meant that she'd cued her radar to really recognize that really early and not get deeply into it or get her state of mind so triggered, because the movement from the first column to the second column is a change of state of mind. And then what she could do then is recognize that and use it as a new cue, a new way to condition herself to get present and centered, and then move into this pre-planned ideal response. So what this is a neural conditioning work page, because you take a cue and you recognize it, use it as a cue first to get centered, but then ultimately to move to a new state, to a new behavior. So when this is practiced for a period of time, it becomes the default mode. So you've created a new response, new neuroassociative conditioning, the same cue, but a different response. It takes practice, though, and it takes work, but it's a way to really be aware of that and to very effectively regulate a state of mind and create an optimum response that ultimately can be the default mode. Now, does that explanation make sense? I know I'm just
absolutely kind of,
okay.
Yep, and I know this chart from previous coaching.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. Right, right.
Yep. Absolutely.
Dave, am I hearing you say that the first step is recognize the cues, identify what the cues are.
The emotional cue or the trigger, because that's what sets the whole thing in motion. Yes.
Okay. And then the change of mind.
And then the second column is the automatic response or behavior to that cue. In other words, you see the cue or hear the cue, and you just immediately react by being pissed off, or, you know, you have the immediate reaction. That's the state change.
Okay.
Let me give you an example. I got permission from her. This is someone in a different training, and I got permission from her to use this. A very accomplished woman who has a number of businesses, and, you know, she said when she gets to a certain point of starting a new business, she has, and this is something she was experiencing now in a business she was beginning, that she has an imposter syndrome. She feels like she's an imposter. She feels like she's been faking it, like she will never make it. And now, with this new business, that people are going to, you know, find out about her. And she realizes it's not logical. There's nothing about it. She can know that she has all the successes. And I said, may I coach you for a moment? And then I later asked her permission to use this. And there's nothing in it for story. So I said, and she said, sure. I'd love for you to. And I said, at the instant that you are aware of this imposter feeling, what's the age of that conversation. And she said, I immediately feel like I'm 16 years old. And I said, that's the state change. Now, what's the cue? What are you responding to? And then she immediately knew and recognized what the cue was, that it was some particular portal of new opportunity that she was about to make public, so that at that moment there was a signal of anxiety that she was handling in a way that created a state change to go back to 16. So what she recognized then was she needed to use this in a way to recognize this and to stay present. And we also talked about, you know, it's not fair to send a 16-year-old out to deal with the kind of things that you'll need to deal with. She said, you're absolutely right. She said, I need to stay and be present and deal with this. And it was a different way of reading the anxiety then about exceptional opportunity without using it in an old way for a state change. Does that example make sense?
Yeah, it certainly did.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So, Chris, does that answer your question now?
Excuse me, yes, it does. One of the things that I wanted to comment on that I thought was interesting to this whole exercise was how I know when I try to make financial decisions, I try to find my center, you know, my center line that I don't want to deviate from. But, I mean, what's interesting in this whole exercise is to see the various ways that you can get pulled off center. And emotion, obviously, is one of the biggest ones. And I thought this exercise really brought that to the forefront. And how you take, I guess how you take it, a decision that you want to make, and unpack everything that's around that's affecting that decision.
That's true. The content of it and what you said earlier is absolutely right about getting really grounded and centered, because when we're centered, we have the most access to all of our states of mind and all the information. And from that place, we make a more balanced decision, left brain, right brain, logical, conscious, intellectual, and emotional. And balanced decisions are ones that are going to be the best decisions. So I think those are really great points about doing that and looking at kind of deconstructing the decision-making process.
Like I said, for me, this has been very beneficial.
It also sounds like you made out like a bandit on your estate sale. Applying
some of these questions. I was totally blown away by the people's reaction. I mean, you talk about emotional decisions. It was like they just wanted to spend money. And you're like, okay. But when we pulled out that
I'm just the man for the job.
We had a phenomenally successful, I mean, we sold stuff we didn't think would sell, and we got pricing way above what we thought we would get. But so much of it was just emotional decisions that were being made right before. I mean, it was just incredible how that happened this past week or last weekend and what we're talking about now.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I was really amazed by the emotion behind people's decisions.
There's a really interesting book called Brainfluence, BrainFluence. It's by Roger Dooley. I do a mastermind group for people who have been invited from the previous training, and I have the last 45 minutes of the 2.5 hours. I have an expert content contributor, and I sent around a copy of his book, and he was the guest. And you know, it's just a fascinating book, and he's a fascinating guy who's done a lot of research and putting together in very practical ways the aspects of how our brains work and how it's a really useful book, I think, for considerations for your practice, and has some very practical aspects about all the things that influence us that we need to understand, I think, in making and running a business and making decisions, just exactly as you're saying. So it's a book I think you'd find of real interest.
Who is the author?
Roger Dooley, Dooley. You know, just a simple little example. I I think he has this in the book. I can't be absolutely sure that I haven't read it somewhere else. But an example of this kind of thing is there was a little girl who had sold more Girl Scout cookies than anybody else in the history of Girl Scouts. And this was like in the, I think, the early 80s. She was on the Johnny Carson show. And, you know, Johnny was intrigued. And he said, well, how do you do it? You know, what's your secret? She said, well, first I asked someone if they would like to donate $25,000 to the Girl Scouts of America. And, you know, he looked kind of surprised. He said, well, does anybody ever do that? And she said, well, no. But then when I said, well, at least would you like to buy a couple of boxes of cookies, they'll all do that. And you think about the kind of thinking, it's just a fascinating process to me to look at things like that. And I think it'll be beneficial for your business here.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks very much.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
And this is a little irrelevant, but the credit card machine sort of got me going because dealing with people that, you know, on this issue of money and they promise that they'll pay you back and that type of thing, but at the end of the day, they really don't come up with it. You know, I'm just wondering if there's any technique understanding how, you know, the brain works to really effectively get them to sort of make good on a loan or that type of thing that you know of.
Now, what's the context? Is it somebody who says they're going to engage your services, or help me understand the context here?
Oh, no, I'm just saying, you know, in a family scenario, you know, you've lent money to someone and they promise, but, you know, they still really don't come through. Obviously, they have some kind of an addiction, and they really don't want to get their finances in order and, you know, that type of thing. But it's amazing to me that this is a reoccurring theme with money, that people don't have a conscience, you know. So I'm just always surprised. I mean, I have a big conscience, so, you know, I just would never do that. So I was just wondering, because in the context of money, and you're so familiar with it, if you have found anything that is particularly effective.
Well, I think we're talking about two addictions here. You're describing one. You're describing the intent that someone has, and they probably consciously believe what they say and want to believe their story, that they intend to do that. And they want to believe that. They want you to believe that they want to do that. They have every good intention. They're saying what they want to live into, but then they may not have a plan or a way or the means to live into it. So it's a temporary way of feeling good by saying what you want to hear, as you know, what the lender wants to hear, and saying what they want to say, I'll make good on it, but they may not have a plan, or they wouldn't have needed to borrow the money in the first place. The other addiction is lending people money and the codependency of trying to take care of somebody. Remember, an addiction is when a behavior becomes the central organizing factor of your life, when you're trying to take care of someone in a way that they may need to function themselves. So at times, the greatest favor that you can do for someone is to not give them money, because you know they're not going to pay you back. They know they're not going to pay you back, although their story is going to counter that. And you're doing something that is creating and enabling.
Yes.
Perhaps.
I completely.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just curious in that scenario, I mean, where does accountability to the debt come, or the consequence of not paying it? If there is no emotion in the consequence, in other words, if it's a family member, I mean, the worst case scenario is if it's a family member and you say, well, either you pay me or I'm going to lock you up, you know, that type of thing, you there's no emotion in it. If it's a family member, there's always going to be emotion.
I think the compromising thing is when boundaries are blurred and the family issues and business issues are blurred, because if it's treated totally as a business, which it may need to be, then you have a contract and consideration and consequence that's written into it. So it's compromising situation, and it can be very complex when you blur the boundaries of family and business. You know, I had, you know, a cousin call me up, you know, some time ago. And it only, well, it's only happened twice. A cousin and his dad, kind of a step-uncle. And to both of them, I said, I, as a principal, I don't mix business with family matters, meaning I don't loan money to people in the family. And it preserved the relationship, and it was no big deal. I don't think they expected it anyhow, but it would have been a big deal if they had borrowed, because I knew they weren't going to pay me back.
Mm-hmm.
You see that a lot.
Oh, agreed. It was just, you know, I didn't know if there was, because you do so much research, I think some of it's fairly common, and I agree. You know, I just didn't know. I mean, I thought the credit card machine was actually pretty interesting because, you know, maybe I should do that. But, you know, I've tried a variety of different things short of being, you know, just very litigious or aggressive or whatever. So I didn't know if there was something that in your research you could share.
Yeah, neither a borrower nor a lender be. Well, we're going to have to stop. We're over time. Thanks very much for all your participation. You made it very intriguing and interesting, and I appreciate that. I look forward to picking up with you next time.
Thank you.
Bye. Next
great. Thank
have
you.
A great rest of the week. See
you. Bye.